Right, yes. Good morning, everyone. Past couple of weeks, as you know, Annette and I have been up at Keswick, and natural enough for me, or easy enough for me, what I want to do is give you a bit of a taste of what we had at the Keswick Convention. Had I known what Dr. Tkach was going to be talking about, I might have picked the following week from the week that I've have selected, because Dr. Tkach was saying there how, you know, in the message of the Good Samaritan, how the Pharisee, the lawyer, was trying to sort of constrain and limit the law, as it were. You know, who exactly is my neighbour? Whenever you're talking about that, how far do I need to go? And in actual fact, in the during week three, what they covered was Liam Gollaher was looking at the Beatitudes, and he was showing how they basically challenged the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all of these who in their time were limiting the law, and how Jesus used the Beatitudes to do exactly the same as he did with the Good Samaritan story. So that would have been a good follow-on, but I'm not doing that one. I'm going to be doing the week before that. And during the week before that, we spent the week during the morning services going through a good section of 2 Kings. Right? Now, 2 Kings, as we were told by Paul Mallard, he's a Brummie, by the way. And he's quite a good sense of humour, and he's a nice bloke, and he sort of unravels the scriptures in an interesting way, and he very much keen on teaching everyone. Look, it's not just me standing up here preaching to you. I want you to see how to unpack all of this stuff for yourself. You know, so he was spending the time saying, you know, you've got to look at the context, and you've got, you know, by context we mean who wrote it, when did they write it, for what purpose was it written. And he says, and through that, he says, you get an underlying theme and message, and he says it brings the section to much more life. And what he was looking at in particular in 2 Kings was Elisha, or as he sort of focused it a little bit more. He says, if you come away at the end of the week saying, we spent the week talking about Elisha, he says, I failed. He says, it's not Elisha we're actually talking about. He says, we're talking about the God of Elisha. He says, I want you to see how God worked through Elisha. He says, the focus has got to be and should always be on God. And I thought, that's actually, you know, that should be a general truth for everything that we teach, because very often we stand up here and we talk about Matthew, or we talk about John, and we talk about Peter, we talk about, you know, this that happened in the Old Testament or that, and we talk about the people, and we lose sight of the fact that they're there not to tell you about them, but to point you to God. And that in itself is a message of context, which actually helps to bring to life what you're reading. Another thing about 2 Kings. 2 Kings is at the end of quite a long section of scripture, which actually runs all the way from Joshua, covering 800 years of history. So you've got Joshua, Judges, and so on and so on, all the way up through to 2 Kings. And those four or five books that are there tell the story of Israel's habitation of the Promised Land. And it comes after a section in Deuteronomy 28. And just worthwhile just looking at what it says there, because this is God talking to Israel at Mount Horeb and saying to them about how they are going to go into the Promised Land. And he puts in front of them, and you remember, the blessings and the cursings, right? He says, if you fully obey, 28 verse 1, Deuteronomy 28 and verse 1, it says, if you fully obey the Lord, your God, it's just, and it shall come to pass there, aye. Oh, I see, yes. You've got the King James version, I'm looking at the NIV. Okay, no worries.
I'll give you the NIV.
Yeah, go for it. Thank you. It looks as if we're saying the same thing then. If you shall fully obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all his commands that I give you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations on earth. All these blessings will come upon you and accompany you if you obey the Lord your God. And it goes on to say through the next few verses, the nature of the blessings. The land will be blessed. The people will be blessed. Everything they do will be blessed. They will have the Midas touch to all intents and purposes. Everything will turn to gold for them. You know, all of their fortunes, they'll only be looking up and up and up. But it comes to a point down in verse 15 where he goes on to say, however, if you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees that I am giving you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. You will be cursed in the city, cursed in the country. Your basket and your kneading trough will be cursed. The fruit of your womb will be cursed. The crops of your land, the calves of your herds, the lambs of your flocks. You will be cursed when you come in, cursed when you go out. In other words, all of those blessings that we talked about will all be taken away. And you won't be left just neutral, right? Curses equals punishment. You will be punished in this way. All of these things will happen to you. And ultimately, what it says is the ultimate curse, if you go on and on and on, it will come to the point where you will be thrown out of the land. Verse 36, it says, the Lord will drive you and the king you set over you to a nation unknown to you or your fathers. There you will worship other gods, gods of wood and stone. You will become a thing of horror and an object of scorn and ridicule to all the nations where the Lord will drive you. And that, to all intents and purposes, is what you call, you know, from God's perspective, that's the ultimate curse. It's the point where God has said, I've had enough of you. I'm disowning you. I'm putting you into exile. He did the same with Adam and Eve. He sent them into exile from the garden. You know, and it points towards, you know, that ultimate exile where those that don't believe, you know, will be cast away. They will be put into exile. They will be separated from the face of God. And what we see in this section of scripture that ends in 2 Kings is actually the story, because God placed this in front of Israel as choice. He places it in front of all of us. This is the choice I put before you. Choose life, you know, he said earlier. But here he's saying, look, as you go into the promised land, if you obey everything I say to you, you'll have all of these blessings. But if you don't, then all of these punishments will follow. And what we actually see from Joshua all the way through Israel's habitation of the land is the fulfillment of everything that God has said to them through this purpose. Because initially, with Joshua and the judges, they obeyed. Right? And they had a time of great prosperity. They had, under the the judges, they were they had a great, don't want to repeat the word prosperity, but, you know, everything was going right for them. The nations round about them respected them. They were not bothered. They had an extended time of peace, and they, everything that they turned their hand to was multiplied 10, 20 times over. And it was, you know, the story is there through all of these times. But then they come to the point where they say, we want a king. We want to be more like the other nations round about us. We want a king, right? And you see that God even says here, this was at a time when he was appointing judges over them, and they were under God's law, grace, and dominion. And that was the rule of the judges. But they came to the point where they said, no, we want a king. We want to be more like the other nations. Now, yes, God identified and gave them the king. And the first king, you know, Saul, then David, we know the stories that happened there. But as time went on, these kings became more and more selfish and self-fulfilling, just like the kings in the other nations. And if you go through the book of Kings, basically, they get to the point where the kings are just rotten apples. They first of all introduce the concept of syncretism, where, okay, yes, Jehovah is Lord, but let's have something that can represent God to us here on earth. And they set up idol worship, you know, pretending that this was Jehovah. So they were worshipping Jehovah, but worshipping him through idols. And then we get to the point where even that isn't enough. You know, at the time of Elijah, the king, the queen, you know, the lady that was in charge was basically going after Baal. They were total pagans. They had left Jehovah entirely. And you know the story of Elijah confronting all of the priests of Baal and calling down fire and consuming the lot of them. You know, not only the altar that they had set up and doused with water, you know, to prove that God is God, Jehovah is king, against all of these all reigned. But the fire then came down and destroyed all of them as well. Bit of poetic justice didn't stop the thing. They just carried on and carried on because it was part of them. Second Kings was actually written, in terms of timing, it was written while Israel were in captivity. So it was after these events. It is a historical book in every respect. It was written as a historical story. This is how we got to where we are at the time that they had been in exile and cast out. So, you know, by the river of Babylon, you know, where we were set down and all the rest of it. And as Paul Mallard says, he's not going to sing it and neither am I. that was the point. That's the time setting in which it was written. So it was written looking back, but it was also written with a mind to where they were. So in actual fact, even although the end of the story is not good in as much as they were taken into exile, the writer also puts in some hope, right? Because throughout the story, what he's doing all the time is pointing, you know, the story of Elijah and reminding the people that were there in exile at that time, remember this happened. Remember the response to Baal and the priests and all the rest of it. And here's the story of Elisha and how God worked through Elisha. And what it does is it keeps saying to you, God is supreme. And no matter where you are, God is with you. So it's sending as well a massive message of hope to the people that were in captivity in Babylon at that time. So, you know, there's one reason that the books are being written is to tell the story. But it's also to give that bit of hope to them. The people were feeling dejected and totally lost. God has deserted us. There's no more future for us. So the writer, under inspiration of God, builds some very powerful imagery into these books. Although they tell this story about how the nations end up being ejected from the promised land into captivity, they are nonetheless full of hope. Right? The main characters, even although it's called 1 Kings and 2 Kings, the main characters aren't the kings. The main characters are men of God, Elijah and Elisha. And they're the prophets that God was working through at the time. The enduring theme is that while kings might come and go, and even as prophets come and go, God remains the same and is always there. So through God's prophets, there's a handover and a handover. There's a continuation. And through the prophets, God is working. God worked through Elijah. God worked through Elisha. Right? And as well as that, Elijah lived through several kings. Elisha lived through several kings. They came and they went. The enduring theme is God through all of it. And when you think about it in that way, it becomes as much a story for us today as it was for them then as well. You know, because where does it say in the Bible that in the last days, you know, people will be losing faith? You know, that will there be anyone found who has got faith remaining in God, you know, in the latter days kind of thing? And we see round about us, you know, we're of an age, a lot of us, many of us. I wish I could find the young ones, you know, where are they? Oh, you're there, Peter, right. you know, we are of an age where we can remember, you know, we were brought up in a Christian culture. When I was brought up, the norm was to go to church, right? There was many that didn't, but more often than not, if you asked people, if you confronted people and challenged people, are you a churchgoer? The default answer was yes, even if the truth was no, right? The default position there was they wanted to be associated with churchgoers because that was acknowledged as being the right thing to do. That was the norm. But today, if you ask somebody if they're a churchgoer, even if they are, they're more likely to say no because they're worried about what might come next. You know, it's totally opposite way around now. Society has turned on its head during my lifetime. And you see these attacks on faith. Our Christian culture is no more. We are what they call multi-faith, which essentially means anti-Christian. You know, because that's really what's happening more than anything else. And I'm not going to get into that. All I'm saying is that this is a good time, actually, to revisit this book of 2 Kings and see the hope that's in it. That, you know, when Elijah was feeling sorry for himself sitting under the tree, you know, oh God, poor me, pity me, I've escaped by the skin of my teeth, they're after me, they're going to get me, I'm the last one that's left, just kill me and get it over with. And what does God say to him? Wake up to yourself, pal. Because, you know, you all know, of course, God's a Scotsman. He says, look, wake up to yourself. You're not the only one. I've got lots more. What was it, 700, 7,000? 7,000. 7,000 that have not bowed the knee to Baal. Right? So you're not on your own. Just because I don't keep you all together and we don't have Facebook pages and all of that, you know, for the club, it doesn't mean that you're on your own. Far from it. It just so happens that I'm working with you as an individual. But don't you worry about that, my friend, because in the not too distant future, I'm going to introduce you to the person who's going to take over from you, Elisha. And we'll, you know, that will give you your opportunity then. If you truly want to depart, then that is when you can do that, you know. But at the moment, I've still got a wee job for you to do, so hang around, you know. And you see that sort of story sort of coming through in all of this. So these books follow a pattern then that's frequently repeated in Scripture as well, that God works in twos, right? Very often you see that. You've got Moses and Joshua, you know. You've got Morecambe and Wise. Sorry, you've got Moses and Joshua. Moses started a job and Joshua picked it up and finished it. You know, because Moses was given the task, wasn't he, of taking the Israelites into the promised land. But because he struck the rock in the wrong way, he did it in his own sort of thing, power, as it were, instead of invoking God. And of all places, on the Mount of God, you know, that he did that, that God says, look, you know, as your punishment, you're not going to see the promised land. That's your task, yes, but tough, you ain't going to see it, right? And what was then happening was that Joshua picked it up and finished the job. He settled Israel in the promised land. And that's where, you know, this story takes on. You've got Moses and Joshua. You've got Elijah and Elisha. And we have John the Baptist and Jesus. That's another coupling, another pairing. And there are patterns evident between these also. If you look at the first, if you look at Moses, Elijah, John the Baptist, and then you look at the seconds, Joshua, Elisha, and Jesus, there's another pattern that emerges. The work of the former is enlarged in the second. You know, Moses did a lot of great things, but look closely at what Joshua did in the completion of it. Elijah did great things, but Elisha did more. John the Baptist did great things as a prophet for God, but Jesus bet the lot of them. You know, and that pairing is evident, that pattern. So if you take, you know, Moses and Elijah, both deeply committed to God's law, that's another similarity between those two. The law came through Moses. Elijah defends the law. Both miraculously provide food for the needy. Both confront kings. Both prayed to die at one point in their ministries. Both met God at Mount Horeb. Both left this world beyond the River Jordan, and both met Jesus at his transfiguration. So, similarities there on the first ones. Joshua and Elisha, their names are similar. Joshua means Jehovah saves. Elisha means God saves. Both succeed a great servant of God. Both miraculously crossed the River Jordan at the start of their ministry. Both confronted the city of Jericho. And both complete the work of their predecessor. And that pattern, as I said, continues between Elisha and Jesus. If you look at those two as a pairing, both began their ministry at the River Jordan. Both had ministries heavily smothered in grace. Both fed the hungry, healed lepers, and raised the dead. At the end of their lives, both saw life coming out of their tombs. right? And this, I mean, what I've given you there, I mean, it is the preface that we were given on the Monday of the week at Keswick. And basically, he was going into those bits there between Elisha and Jesus, those similarities, and showing the miracles that actually pair all of those up. Now, I'm not going to try and do 5 hours of preaching in the 15 minutes that remain. If indeed, you know, you can hang around for that long. That's not what I'm intending to do. What I want to do is just give you a taster or a flavour. Because you can actually download the talks from Keswick. All of the main talks from Keswick, if you go onto the Keswick Convention website, you can download them directly. You can also see them in DVD format through clayton.tv on the web. You can actually look them up. And they've got several years' worth of stuff. You know, so, you know, I'm not, to the extent that I've pinched one good sermon out of this to sort of start us off, I'm not proposing to sort of rob, you know, sort of those sermons in order to sort of take them, deliver them to you. What I'm saying to you is they're great studies. You know, do go online and, you know, sort of download them, listen to them for yourself and do that. They are good. But at the moment, let's just have a quick look in 2 Kings chapter 2, if we may. 2 Kings in chapter 2. I need to try and find it as well. Yeah, there we go. 1 Kings. This is the story of the swap over between Elijah and Elisha. And in 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse 1, and I'll read on a wee bit, and it basically it's just picking out a very important point here about this continuation and the fact that God remains through it all. It says, chapter 2, verse 1, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. The company of the prophets at Jericho. Now, these companies of the prophets, these were Bible schools, to all intents and purposes, that Elijah had set up. And what he was doing was he was like doing a sort of like goodbye tour. He was doing a circuit of the Bible colleges that he had set up by way of saying farewell to the people that he had been working with. So if you think of it in that way. And by the way, what they're doing through the day is about 25 miles. You know, so this is all in one day, right? So the company of the prophets at Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," he replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. 50 men of the company of the prophets went and stood at a distance facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. Right? So he used his cloak, smote the water with it, and it divided so that they could cross over on the Jordan. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, What can I do for you before I am taken from you? Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit, Elisha replied. Now, a double portion of the spirit does not mean a double portion of the spirit of God as it resides in Elijah. Rather, it harks back to the inheritance rules. What Elisha was saying is, treat me as your firstborn son. Allow me to inherit what you have started. That's what Elisha is saying here. Allow me to inherit your job, your role, and everything else. So, you know, because if you look through the inheritance laws, what it is the firstborn gets a double portion, and then the remainder, so they get half, and then the half is split up among however many are left, as it were. So, and of course, the idea there is that the firstborn then continues the work of the parent, etc. So that's essentially what he's saying here. And Elijah replies to me, says in verse 10, you have asked a difficult thing, Elijah said. Yet, if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours, but otherwise not. As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this and cried out, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel. And Elisha saw him no more. That's another, my father is not my father in heaven. You know, the chief prophet is always referred to as my father. If you read on, even the king refers to Elisha as father. Father, what shall I do with them? You know, whenever he captures a band of raiding troops from a rebel king, as it were, from outside. So, father was him crying after Elijah. And this bit that he's saying here, you know, the chariots and horsemen of Israel. I mean, that is, to all intents and purposes, you know, you're the power, you know, you're God on this earth. What are we going to do without you? You know, you're it, as it were. This is Elisha recognizing what's happening. He's losing, you know, and we all know, you can know that you're going to lose someone, but at the time that it happens, it hits you. Even no matter how much notice you've had, and this is happening here. He says, Elisha saw him no more. What did he do? He took hold of his own clothes and tore them apart. He went into grieving. He grieved because he knew that that was it. He picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen from him and struck the water with it. Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah? He asked when he struck the water. It divided to the right, to the left, and he crossed the river. So where was the God of Elijah? He had passed and into Elisha. And, you know, so the double portion had come. And just as God had worked with Elijah, this was the reassurance that he was working in the same way with Elisha. So you see, Elijah crossed one way, Elisha crossed back using exactly the same method with God's intervention and God's power. And, you know, I won't go any further, but, you know, you can read on, you know, the company of the 50 prophets that were there, they came had the brilliant notion that, look, you know, maybe God has put them down somewhere in one of the hills close by. Let us go and look for them. And Elisha had said, look, you're wasting your time. You know, don't bother. No, no, Lord, we must go. And carried on. He'd said, okay, then go. So they went and had a look around. But then they came back after 3 days and says, we couldn't find them. And Elisha says, told you it was a waste of time. But all I'm wanting to say to you is, you know, that's a bit of a flavour, you know, of the way in which the week that we had at Keswick sort of went out. You know, you can see from the miracle there that we've covered and addressed that the God is supreme in all of this, and that God acts through each of his prophets, and that even although Elijah was no more, the God of Elijah was still there. The God of Elijah was now the God of Elisha, and God of Elisha would continue to do great things through Elisha, you know, even to the extent that when he's put into his tomb and there was a band of raiders came by, they were burying this poor guy that had died, and some raiders came down, and in a rush they just threw him into Elisha's tomb in order to that they could get out the way quickly. But as soon as his body touched Elisha's bones, he sprung back up into life and went off. And of course there was also the son of the Shumanite that he raised from the dead as well, a young boy. He had prophesied that she would give birth when she had failed to have children, and her father, the father was excessively old and all the rest of it. But, you know, the big difference being that he did all of these things in the power of God. Jesus, being God, did all of these things directly, as it were. So, you know, we had a terrific week listening to all of these things, and the message that's in this book is very inspiring. And if you focus on God and the story of God through Elijah and Elisha on into the other books, you know, there's a lot to get out of it. And I would thoroughly recommend that if you get the chance, do download them, listen to them, and enjoy. So, thank you. Let me see. Sorry, Hugh.